Taped from New Jersey, it's the SNL Nerds, a show where two comics from New Jersey nerd out about Saturday Night Live. I'm your co-host, Darren Patterson.
And I'm your co-host, John Trumbull.
Hey, John, how's it going?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing?
I'm good. You enjoying this cruel summer? Leaving me here on my own?
It is a very Bananarama summer.
Yes. I like to start off every episode now with like a summer song, because this is our summer break extravaganza.
Right. And it's apparently the summer of 1983.
Yes.
Because we're making Bananarama references.
What, the kids don't know that?
I don't know.
The kids don't get that reference?
I don't know. There are probably a fair amount of people our age who listen to this podcast. So
yeah.
They appreciate a nice Bananarama reference.
I don't make references for the kids, John. I make it for old fogies like us, like these kids with their SoundClouds and what have you. They listen to whatever they want to listen to in their own time. The little Xan and, and yada yada and going down the Old Town Road. I do jokes strictly for the oldies.
Can we name any Bananarama songs besides Cruel Summer and their cover of Venus? I don't think I can.
Manic Monday?
That was the Bangles.
We Got the Beat.
That was the Go-Go's.
You
are very bad at this.
2 for 2.
Let's just say no and move on.
Okay. But I was trying to think of a song by another girl group, like the Chipettes or something, but I got nothing.
But this week we are continuing our summer format of watching Saturday Night Live movies. Movies spun off from Saturday Night Live sketches.
Yes, the people clamored for it, and here we are. That's right. Yeah, so you hear that clamoring? A lot of clamoring.
Yeah, and what's the movie we got in store for the good people?
Well, today, the movie we have in store for the good people, it's a summer movie, came out in July 23rd of 1993. Little movie called Coneheads.
Yes.
Yeah, summer of 93. Same summer, actually, that came out, that brought us a movie called Last Action Hero, and a small indie film, let's see if I pronounce this correctly, Jurassic Park.
Okay.
All the summer of 93.
All right. That really pinpoints us in time.
Yes. So now you have a good frame of reference.
I mean, we all remember the Coneheads mania of 1993.
Oh, my God.
You could not turn a street corner without seeing the prosthetic cones on people's heads.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
Oh, my God.
It was crazy. I tell you. Everybody was like, consume mass quantities.
Yeah. Meps. Remember those days?
And
you couldn't escape. It's just Conehead Comic Cons everywhere. Conacon.
Yeah. Had you seen this movie before?
I'd seen it years ago. I mean, well, I didn't see it in the theater because this came out.
Hardly anyone saw it.
Yeah,
in the
I know. We'll get to that. We'll get to that. Well, this came out in '93, so I was in high school. I think I just started high school. I was like sophomore or freshman in high school.
Uh-huh.
And I did not see it in the theater because, I mean, to be honest, like the Coneheads sketch, it never really drew me in.
Not one of your favorites.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say that as an SNL nerd, but like
Coneheads. I'm going to have to take your membership card.
Oh, damn it. Turning your gun and badge.
Yes.
Damn it. You're off the force. but yeah, like, I mean, as far as Coneheads sketches go, like, I always thought they were okay enough. I never got like big belly rolls of laughter out of them.
Yeah.
I was like, all right, I get it. They speak in this, like the staccato type of thing. And they down 6 packs of beer and consume mass quantities and whatnot. All right, I get it. So I was never a huge fan of the sketches. So when the movie came out, I was like, well, I don't like the sketches. Why would I like the movie?
Yeah. And then that's a good rationale.
And that's that. And then I went to see Jurassic Park.
Okay. I also gave this movie a miss in the summer of 93.
Right.
And,
same reason, like the Conehead sketches never
I was always fine with the Conehead sketches. I thought they were funny. I did not think this movie was funny.
Ooh.
So I just want to say, good call, 21-year-old me.
High five.
Nice going. You have discerning taste.
You dodged the bullet. Yeah, but yeah, I mean, yeah, I mean, so we watched the movie again, and oh, well, we'll just get into a little of the backstory.
Yeah, let's talk a little about the backstory of the Coneheads, because the backstory of the Coneheads, I think, is probably more interesting than the movie itself.
Yeah, I heard Dan Aykroyd came up with he's one that came up with the whole Coneheads concept, because he was vacationing somewhere, I think I heard.
He and Tom Davis, the Christmas hiatus of the second season of SNL, they went on a vacation to Easter Island, where they have the big statues with the big heads. And they said that that was what inspired the Conehead sketch. If you hang on a second, I'm gonna, I brought some reference material.
You have charts?
So I have charts and graphs, and I have to turn to page 140 this book.
All right, I'll allow it. Yeah. I'll allow it in my courtroom tremble, but you better be going somewhere with this.
I'll allow it, but watch yourself, counselor.
Okay. Well, while you're looking for it, do you find it?
No.
Okay, so while you're looking for it, let's get into the background of the movie. Written by Dan Aykroyd and Tom Davis, and by Bonnie and Terry Turner, who also wrote Wayne's World. They wrote Bonnie and Terry Turner. They were SNL writers. They wrote Wayne's World. They wrote Tommy Boy. And they also worked on Third Rock from the Sun many years later.
Yes, so they have much experience with aliens.
Yes. So, oh, yeah. I didn't even notice that. Hey.
So I found a relevant quote from Dan Aykroyd. He says, this is from the book Live from New York, The Complete Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live, told by its stars, writers, and guests by James Andrew Miller and Tom Shales.
Ooh, which great book, guys.
Yeah, we have referenced many times before. If you have any interest in SNL, pick up this book.
Oh.
So this is from page 140. Dan Aykroyd says, the Coneheads started out as pinhead lawyers of France. I had been looking at a TV. I guess I'd smoked a J or something. And I thought, everybody's heads don't really reach the top of the screen. Wouldn't it be great if you added 4 inches to everybody? So I drew up this design, and we would be pinhead lawyers of France. But then people were afraid that we'd be disparaging encephalic people or retarded people with that. So
thank
we
you.
Changed. wait, I lost my place here after I rang the problematic bell.
Bell.
Yeah, yeah. So we changed it to the Coneheads, and Lauren said, "Why don't you put it in an alien setting? Aliens coming to work." So we tried it out in a comedy workshop downtown, and that's where it came from. It evolved in the writing. And then here's another quote from Robin Schillen. I'm not sure what her position was on the show, because this wasn't her first quote in the book. It says, the production assistants used to play a game. We'd get the sketches, and then it would be like, what drug were they on when they wrote this one? The pot sketches were all a certain way. That was one of the funny things about getting all those handwritten pages that we had to type up. A lot of pot smoking went on when the people were writing, like the Coneheads. That was a total pothead sketch, the quintessential pot sketch. Here they are, these really weird people with things on their heads, and they say they're from France, you know. So that was Dan Aykroyd's version of the origin of the Coneheads, and
it all came from pot. Is that what you're trying to say?
Pretty much.
The Blues Brothers came from cocaine. This came from pot.
Yeah,
wow.
I'd say, yeah.
Thank you, Narcotics. You've given us so much.
Narcotics, you formed so much of modern comedy. but there's also like a bit of a controversy.
What?
Yeah. I went deep on this. Have you ever heard of the comic strip character Zippy the Pinhead?
That sounds familiar.
Okay, Zippy the Pinhead is a character from an underground San Francisco-based cartoonist by the name of Bill Griffith, and he created Zippy in 1970. He first appeared in 1971 in a comic book, and it eventually became the syndicated comic strip that is, I believe, still going today.
Ooh.
And very similar appearance to the Coneheads. If you do a Google image search on Zippy the Pinhead, it's you know, the same sort of pointed head. He's got a bow at the top of his head and a little tufts of hair.
Oh, see, but
and he's got the collar. And
but Coneheads like don't have the bow, so totally different.
So
and case dismissed.
And he was raising a little bit of a stink about this around the time the movie was released, when the Coneheads were at their highest profile.
Oh, when the movie came out.
Yeah.
But what about when the actual sketch was out?
I don't think he made much of a public fuss, but here it says, he became a well-known character among underground comic book aficionados by 1972. This is an LA Times article, by the way, from 1993.
Yeah, okay.
While the Coneheads didn't appear on SNL until 1976 or thereabouts, it was actually January 77, because it was right after the Christmas vacation, One of Zippy's biggest fans was SNL legend John Belushi, who wrote a letter to Griffith in the show's early years and asked if Zippy could serve as guest host. It's my understanding that Aykroyd was turned on to Zippy by Belushi, Griffith says. Aykroyd's statement says that he never saw Zippy until Griffith made this claim years back. Another factor, says Griffith, is that a, quote, major writer who used to be with Saturday Night Live, this is an unnamed writer, confided to a former colleague, New York-based publisher Jeff Rund, who in turn told Griffith that Aykroyd mainly got the idea of the Coneheads from Zippy. Griffith adds that Aline Kaminsky, the wife of famed underground cartoonist R. Crumb, relayed the same information from the same SNL writer. So, he did. Bill Griffith did like three strips about this from 1993. You know, how is it, just kind of having fun and he's sort of venting his spleen about it. But
but he never, it's not, I mean, it's not that he was upset, but he never, like, he never sued or anything? Or
it never got to that point. Ann Beats, former SNL writer from the show's early years, she says that the connections are vague at best and the ripoff issue is goofy. And
goofy.
Yeah, she argues
that the legal term right there.
The show's it is a legal distinction.
Your Honor, this is goofy.
The show's performers and writers, she says, quote, didn't have a collective unconscious. Dan and the writer Tom Davis did the Coneheads, not Belushi. Besides, says Beats, ideas are out there in the zeitgeist, floating around like spores. Who knows how they travel from one mind to the other? And here, Aykroyd, his statement says that the idea for Coneheads was predicated from my seeing daguerreotype plates of circus pinheads made in France at the turn of the century. Bill Griffith said that he was inspired by when he watched the movie Freaks. Because there is a genuine person with that condition. Schlitzy, the pinhead, is what he was known as. Which I believe the condition is called microcephaly.
Okay.
I looked up. That's the actual.
Wowee.
But so I just wanted to note that I don't know what to believe there, of course, but
the truth is out there.
Yeah, you know.
Wow. No, that's great. I didn't know anything about that. That's
So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, no, it was. So, I don't know. Wow. I'm beside myself with this.
But however the Coneheads were created, they originally appeared on SNL January 15th, 1977. They appeared in a total of 11 sketches. So it was between January of 77 and February of 79.
11 and times in 2 years?
Yeah, that's a lot.
That's
right?
A lot.
That's a lot. But
those are like Californian numbers.
They were smoking a lot of weed, I'm guessing.
You don't say.
Whenever they did, they got another idea for a Conehead sketch.
Let's have them on Family Feud.
But I always found that amusing. I also was surprised to discover when I was researching this, there was also an animated special in 1983.
What?
Did you not hear this?
I did not hear this.
Okay, I saw this like noted on the trivia page on IMDb, and then I went and I found the special on YouTube, and it was like a pilot that didn't sell.
Oh, wow.
And it was done by Rankin Bass.
Oh, from Ren and Stimpy?
No.
Is that another?
Rankin Bass were the guys who did like the Rudolph Christmas specials, stop motion things. But this was an animated thing.
What the hell am I thinking about?
I don't know. Okay. You're smoking J's with Dan. I know. I guess. But I watched it, and it was written by Al Franken and Tom Davis. It was very similar in certain ways to the movie, where it has a similar plot line where it's
they
crash land. It's, you know, Aykroyd's character of Beldar and his wife Primat, played by Jane Curtin. They crash land on Earth. They're like a precursor to an invasion force, but they're stranded on Earth for years and years and years. He makes a living as a TV repairman. And they have a daughter, Connie.
Right.
Who's a little more
Americanized,
as you can say. Yeah, and so very similar. And
okay,
you know.
All right. Wow. Well, maybe we'll put that up on the page, or
yeah, we should put up a link or something like that in the show notes.
Not too shabby. Yeah. Well, I mean, another thing about this movie was directed by Steve Barron, who I'd never heard of before, but then I looked into what he's done.
Yes,
it's very impressive. Like, this guy has a career that I kind of want, because I mean, before this movie, he'd done a lot of music videos. Do you know Steve Barron or?
Not personally, no.
Have you heard of him?
Yes. Well, I mean, I don't think I really had before I started researching this. All but right. Yes.
Well, Steve Barron has done a number of music videos in the 80s, and I'm going to read you some of the music videos he directed.
Oh, okay. This is interesting. I haven't heard about this.
He directed the music video for Don't You Want Me and Fascination by the Human League.
Okay.
Thomas Dolby, She Blinded Me with Science.
Oh, that's classic.
Africa and Rosanna by Toto. He did Steppin' Out by Joe Jackson. He did Burning Up by Madonna. Electric Avenue by Eddie Grant. Billie Jean by Michael Jackson.
Wow.
Heaven, Run to You, and Summer of 69 by Bryan Adams.
Whew, Bryan Adams trifecta.
Yeah. All She Wants to Do Is Dance by Don Henley. Money for Nothing by Dire Straits. And
classic.
Take on Me by A-ha!
Wow.
He directed all of those videos.
Wow. That is quite an impressive video directing career.
He directed the 80s.
He did.
And that's like a Fuddruckers playlist of hits. And like the first movie he ever did, a little thing in 1990 called The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
I thought he did like one before that.
I didn't see it. I think that was like the first one. He definitely directed it. I'm pretty sure that was his first one.
I could have sworn I saw the. Okay. Well, I don't have a list. I don't have a page for Steve Barron up, but I thought he directed something before that, way before that.
Well, I mean, you can look it up. I don't think so. But
yeah.
But I mean,
give me a minute.
But yeah, I mean, it's an impressive director. He had an impressive resume. But I think as you alluded to a little bit earlier, like this movie wasn't a hit. It had a $33 million budget and only made like $21 million. So it wasn't a huge flop, but it wasn't knocking people over.
He directed a movie called Electric Dreams in 1984, which was a science fiction romantic comedy set in San Francisco. Depicts the love triangle among a man, a woman, and a personal computer. Oh, that old story.
Isn't that her from the Spike Jonze movie?
It was her, but like 30 years earlier.
Whoa.
I guess. He was also an assistant cameraman on a movie called Trauma, 1976, The Duelists, which was a Stanley Kubrick film.
Okay.
A Bridge Too Far, Superman the Movie. Although he's uncredited for that.
That's
kind of impressive, too.
Dude's got hits.
Yeah, and he directed some television, too. And he didn't go on to too many things after this. He did The Specialist, which was a 1994 spy film with Sylvester Stallone, Sharon Stone, and James Woods.
That sounds familiar.
I vaguely remember. Oh, he directed While You Were Sleeping. I take that back.
Okay.
That's probably his biggest credit that most people would remember.
The Bullock film.
Sandra Bullock, where she falls in love with the man who then falls into a coma.
Sandy B.
And then she falls in love with Bill Pullman, his brother.
Well, oof.
As you do.
That's a love triangle right there.
So, yeah.
That's an electric dream.
So that's Steve Barron, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, not bad.
But I didn't know about all the music videos. That's interesting.
Yeah, he's done a lot. I mean, those were just some of them. I thought those were more hype. But like, if you look at the other stuff he's done, he's directed a video for Bowie and ZZ Top. Like, he's done some stuff.
Nice.
Yeah, but
we salute you, Steve Barron.
Yeah, I mean, he did this movie. I mean, I don't know. What are your feelings about this movie? There's a few things I did like.
It was 86 minutes long.
It's a very short movie.
It's a very short movie. It does not seem like a short movie.
Ooh.
Let's
start with the things we liked about. Like, I liked the Jersey tie-ins.
Yes. The film pretty much takes place in New Jersey. They settle in Paramus, New Jersey.
Yeah. And there was a scene, the football scene, was shot in Paramus High School.
Yes, I read that. And actually, the animated special that I was talking about a few minutes ago, that also takes place in New Jersey, or at least partially. Their commander tells them that they have to be within 20 miles of the United Nations because they're going to announce they're taking over Earth.
Right.
And they go to Paramus, New Jersey, which is apparently within 20 miles of the United Nations.
So there you go.
And you actually see them commuting on Route 80, on Interstate 80.
Nice.
On their way to New Jersey.
All right. Well, so aliens, if you're listening.
Jersey represent.
Jersey strong. And like, I think they did mention at one point when Beldar first landed that he was like working in Jersey City in this movie. The Air Force base that picked him up, there's spacecraft, it's in Wrightstown, New Jersey. So it's very Jersey centric. So basically in the movie, it's basically like you described, where a spaceship crash lands playing on taking over Earth, but they get stranded on Earth in New Jersey, so they try to assimilate with amongst the humans.
And while they're doing this, we have Michael McKean as an INS deputy commissioner who's after them, and David Spade is his sidekick.
Yeah, I did like Spade's name in this. Turnbull.
Yes, I noticed that. Mm-hmm. That the last name Turnbull is mentioned early on in the film, and that like perked my ears up a little bit. Turnbull's actually the name of the Scottish clan that my family is derived from.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah.
Huh.
So I might be a distant relation to David Spade's character in the Coneheads movie.
David.
I haven't done the genealogy. I haven't done like the 23andMe on it.
You didn't spit in a cup and mail it out.
I don't know if they can like tell your relationship to a fictional character. I feel like that might be beyond their abilities.
Yeah, David Spade, if you're listening, you come onto the podcast and clear this up once and for all.
Yeah,
people have been clamoring. There's been so much clamoring.
We want to know about the Turnbull Trumbull connection. What are you hiding, David Spade? What are you hiding?
It goes all the way to the top.
Yeah.
That leads to another thing I liked about this movie. There were so many cameos in this film.
Over a dozen SNL cast members, past and present, in this. I mean, we of course you have Dan Aykroyd and Jane Curtin as the two main characters, Beldar and Primat.
Right. Chris Farley's in it. Adam Sandler's in it. Mm-hmm. David Spade's in it. Lovitz is in it.
Phil Hartman.
Lorraine Newman's in it. Garrett Morris is in this.
Kevin Nealon. Jan Hooks.
Yeah. Tom Davis is in this for a bit.
Julius Sweeney. Tim Meadows.
Tim Meadows is in this for a little bit.
There were some more that were cut out of the movie. There was a. Where was this? I think this was on the IMDb trivia. Scenes featuring Colleen Camp, who we talked about last week in Wayne's World.
Oh, that's right.
Ellen Cleghorn, Brian Doyle Murray, and Conan O'Brien were filmed but cut.
Wow.
So
it's bonkers. And I mean, that's just the SNL alum. There's a bunch of other like cameos from celebs too. Like Jason Alexander's in this for a bit as their neighbor, and Sinbad is in it, and
Eddie
Griffin's in this, and Michael Richards in this. Like one of the first scenes. Dave Thomas, he's like the head Coneheadian.
I realized after I watched this movie, I have an old issue of Cine Fantastique that has an interview with director Steve Barron. He talked a little about that. He was allowed to have free reign to choose actors. From Saturday Night Live, they were like made available for the smaller roles. Let's see, he has a quote about this. He says, "We needed people who had a comic sense of timing, and the SNL alums were part of the Lorne Michaels family, as it were. We looked at them all individually, thought where they could be put, and in the case of David Spade, we actually wrote his part for him." So
that seems about that does seem like the part he played in this movie seems pretty perfect for him.
Well, yeah, I mean he's like this sort of smarmy sidekick guy who's like a little suck up and
I did like that part when he like there was just sort of ongoing thing throughout the movie where like Spade works for Michael McKean's character in the INS,
right?
And so whenever somebody has something to hand to Michael McKean's character, David Spade kind of interjects and be like, you know what, he's kind of busy right now, let me give that to him.
It'd be best if it came from me, and then he like takes credit for
it. Yeah, so he's like, oh hey, look, I got you something.
Yeah.
I kind of dug that little thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, and also this movie had like a quick cameo from Drew Carey and a little unknown person named Ellen DeGeneres was in this too.
It was their film debuts for both of them.
That was bonkers.
Do you think they ever brag about that? It was like, hey, you know, my first film was a little thing called Coneheads.
Yeah. I played the diving coach.
I was a taxi cab passenger.
Parker Posey's in it for a little bit, and Joey Lauren Adams.
Did we mention Michael Richards?
Yes, he was like the guy at the hotel, Holiday Inn.
So
it's pretty impressive.
It's jam-packed with it, and honestly, I found it was to the point where I found it distracting.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of those people weren't big names when they got the role. So, like, I guess a lot of those people were...
Well, I mean, certainly Drew Carey and Ellen DeGeneres and like Eddie Griffith were, but I think most everybody else was known to some degree.
Oh yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah,
Seinfeld was already on, so people knew who Jason Alexander was. And,
oh yeah, that's true. But yeah, so you find it distracting all those?
I did, because it was just
became more of a game. Oh, hey, there he is.
It was
like
a Where's Waldo type of thing. You
know? Look at that.
There's this person. There's this person. There's that person, and it's. I don't know if I want to say it was taking me out of the movie because that kind of implies that I was engaged by the movie at some point.
Wow. But this is scathing.
I mean, my basic feeling on it, it was just there. It was just kind of a nothing burger of a movie. I didn't think it was particularly funny. It had this weird meandering plot.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
But at the same time, it was short, though. Yeah, but it wasn't really bad enough for me to enjoy the badness of it. So it was just kind of like, it was just very mediocre.
Yeah, I guess what you mean. There were like a few scenes, like when they first land and they go into their hotel room to spend the night, and there's just like him eating toilet paper. I feel like him eating like a roll of toilet paper.
Yeah.
And eating soap. That, I feel like that was just parts just for
the trailer. Yeah.
I mean, I did like the part where Primat was like reading the Bible and laughing out loud at it.
That was cute. That was cute. Right. I mean, that was like the closest thing they had to an edgy joke. You know, I mean, some gags like, you know, Primat's vacuuming and then she has the vacuum hose in her mouth.
Yeah.
So she's providing the suction.
I feel like that was just for the trailer.
Yeah.
It's like, we need to show people these people are nutty.
But
yeah, for the most part, it was... Yeah, I see what you mean.
Yeah. I mean, like, right at the beginning, right when they land on Earth, they go into this late-night motel.
Right.
Where Michael Richards is the night guy, and he's watching an episode of Star Trek. He's watching, if you know Star Trek, he's watching the episode Arena, which is where the classic episode where Kirk fights the Gorn. I'm just like, you know, this isn't a good thing at the beginning, because, like, now I'm just wishing I was watching Star Trek. and then like a few minutes later, we see a clip from It's a Wonderful Life, and I'm like, you've already brought up like two other things that would entertain me more than this movie is so far.
Wow, damn, son. All right, I see what you're saying,
but you liked it a little more. It sounds
a
like.
Little. I mean, maybe liked it isn't a word. I found it. I found it a little bit more charming.
Yeah.
I'll say that.
Okay.
I mean, I did like the parts I kind of dug where Michael McKean kind of plays, you know, evil INS.
I enjoyed Michael McKean
and
in
like
the movie.
When he introduced him, that he has this idea of like he has this little model where he proposes an idea of like, oh yeah, for people in Mexico, we could put like shock collars on them.
Yeah,
and then when they try to cross the border, they'll like burst into flames.
Remember when like immigrants coming into the country from Mexico and other places. Remember when that was a big controversy? Thank God we figured that all out.
Figured it all out. Everything's that's not a platform for anybody to run a presidency on.
Yeah.
No. Yeah. We figured that out.
Nope. You know, thank God that problem is resolved and we figured it all out in the 26 years since this movie.
Yep. We've learned everything and everything's just peaches and gravy.
We are so much wiser than we were back then. I mean, we live in a hellscape helpless.
But yeah, I mean, for the most part, I see what you mean. Like, I thought, of course, Chris Farley is always the charming gent in the movie. Wow, you don't even agree with that.
Well, I mean, Chris Farley did what he had to do well, but I mean, I was. Okay, there's a scene where he like takes Connie out on a date, and then he comes back and he's like getting fresh with her, and he's pushing her to go further.
They're playing that Red Hot Chili Peppers song in the background.
Yeah, and then he's like no, and then Connie comes in, and then Dan Aykroyd comes out, and he rips the roof off his car and roughs him up a little bit, and then I was like, oh well, that's it for Chris Farley. Oh, okay, well, and then he comes back later and he's
like a miserable without her,
and he's presented as like a legitimate romantic interest, and I was just like, I don't think this would fly today. This is like,
I see what you mean.
He's on the verge of like forcing himself on the Connie character, so I couldn't really get behind the character after that. You know?
Yeah,
I mean, I'm looking at this very much through 2019 eyes instead of 1993 eyes. But
no, I see what you mean. It was a little. He was getting date rapey.
Yeah,
and like the fact is like, but I'm sad and I'm sorry, so everything's okay now.
Yeah, and then like they had a scene where like he apologizes to her, and then like she apologizes to him, and I'm like, What the hell are you apologizing to him for?
I don't remember that part. Did he?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
All right.
And I was like, okay, this is creepy as hell.
Problematic. All right.
Yeah. So big old ring on the problematic bell on that one.
Holy. Maybe I blocked that out. All right.
I mean, it's a quick thing. He does apologize first, and then she apologizes back. But I'm just like, no, Connie, no.
This is how it
acknowledge your power.
Yes. Yas, queen.
Yes.
Yas, queen. Yas. But yeah,
that So I had a tough time with that subplot.
That's a very woke way to look at it. But it was that part. And well, as the movie goes on, they land. Their original mission is to, you know, take over Earth. But I think they crash down on Earth, and then they make a call. They're able to get it. He's able to get a job through like Sinbad's like kind of little fix it shop.
Yeah,
and because like Beldar's very good with electronics and fixing things.
Right.
So he fashions himself like a telecommunicator. He's able to get contact with his people, and they say,
and this is like years later.
Yeah, and they say, well, we can be there in like 15 years or something.
It was like 7 Zarns, but we have no idea how many Earth years that is. But it's obviously a long time.
Exactly. And, so they're pretty much stranded on Earth until the people can come get them.
Like in the same scene, Primat is like, "Oh, I'm pregnant. I am with Cone."
Yeah, and you see a little cone poke out of her belly.
By the way, they do the pregnancy in the animated special too, but they handled it differently there. Right. Like here, like her stomach enlarges like an Earth pregnancy, although you see like a little extra bulge out of her tummy from the presumably the cone.
Right.
In the animated thing, she gives birth through her cone.
Ah.
And they have like the top of her head covered up. But where does it come out?
There's no hole in the.
I don't know, because it was covered up, and it was like an animated thing.
Okay,
so
it's a cartoon.
We didn't get into the explicit all the whys and wherefores of conehead births.
Oh, none of this is real.
No, wow. But I was like, oh, well, that's a more creative way to do it.
I don't know why they did the. That makes sense.
I don't get why they did it, because I think you know, her giving birth through the cone is funnier.
It is. Yeah. A person with a big old. I don't know.
Yeah.
But
I think we're putting more thought into this right now than the filmmakers did.
poor Paul, Bonnie, and Terry Turner. But so they're stuck on Earth, and he's able to get some jobs. He's a cab driver at first, so INS is still on their tail, but they're able to escape, and then they're able to sort of hide out and lay low in Paramus. There's a little bit of like a allegory for like immigration in this movie, which I really didn't expect, like about, you know, how people from other countries and planets, like, you know, come to America for the American dream. There's like that, you know, the little bit of a theme.
Yeah,
there.
I mean, they are kind of assimilated Americans.
Yeah,
and yeah, they come to enjoy Earth and the planet. And like in the big climax of the movie, we have the INS. They get onto the Coneheads.
Yeah, yeah,
and they're after them. They've cornered them in their cul-de-sac where they live.
Right.
But then, just then, when they're about to be arrested by INS, or they're trying to get away from INS, the spaceship from Remulac comes down and like beams them up, and it also beams up Michael McKean and David Spade's characters. Right. And then we have this whole thing on the planet Remulac where Beldar fights this stop motion creature.
Yeah, that's another thing. The effects weren't up to par.
Well, I actually enjoyed the stop motion creature because it was like intentionally retro and I mean I liked that.
Hey, you think they did that as like a nod to the Star Trek episode where he was fighting the monster there?
I didn't see any like explicit parallels, but that's certainly possible.
I just thought of that.
Yeah.
Hey, how about that?
I mean,
I could have written this movie.
It could be. It would have been funny if they played like the Star Trek fight music, you know, the dun 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 dun, dun, you know, because this is a Paramount film, so they probably could have done that.
If Cable Guy was able to do it, they can.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh God, I love that.
That would have been fun.
Cable Guy is awesome.
So I enjoyed that part.
Yeah, but maybe as far as like effects go, I meant like the part where Connie was eating the Subway.
Oh, that is bad. That is some bad CGI. Where Connie Conehead, she eats like a foot long Subway sandwich.
Yeah, in seconds.
And chomps it down, and it is, even for 1993, that is bad, because that is still a post Terminator 2 world.
Yeah, that looked rough.
It was bad.
I was like, you spent $33 million on this? Really? It doesn't show.
That's
from that.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, they had to have their Subway tie-in, I guess.
I guess that Subway money only went so far. As long as you're talking about the effects, I found this interesting was when they're flying back to Remulac, we have the same sort of warp starfield effect that they used on Star Trek: The Next Generation.
Oh yeah.
So that was either done in the same way, or it was used in this, like they used the actual footage from
Next Gen. I didn't even notice that.
So that was kind of neat.
That was kind of neat. Yeah, and I don't know if you saw it felt this way too, but I kind of felt, there was like a vibe throughout some of the movie where like some of the scenes kind of had like a Tim Burton-y type of feel to it. Now I wonder, if that's what they were going for.
I don't know if consciously, because I don't know if, you know, Tim Burton's style was as defined back then. I can't remember. Well, Edward Scissorhands came out in like 1990, so I guess maybe. There was a similar thing because we have the Coneheads in Suburbia.
Yeah.
And they're the weird ones. And like the big joke is that nobody really notices or comments on
the
their odd appearance or their odd behavior.
No, that's not true.
Usually don't.
Usually. There was one part where another cameo, Tom Arnold, when they were at the... on the golf course, and like the first thing Tom Arnold says when he's looking at him, says, "Hey, dude, what's with your head?" And it's because he's like the big jerky dude, and that's like that's kind of the thing we're all thinking at the audience, like, how come no one's talking about these people's weird heads? Or is everybody so woke that they won't say anything about the head? I mean, that's a good thing.
Yeah,
but then Tom Arnold just kind of comes out and says what a lot of people are thinking, like, why didn't anybody say anything about their heads are oddly shaped.
I don't remember that. I mean, I remember Tom Arnold showing up, and then I think I like looked at my phone for a little bit.
Jesus, wow, you!
Not terribly engaged by this movie because, well, I just bottom line, I didn't find it very funny.
Anyway, no, that's fine. It's fair enough.
It was just there, and I thought, yeah, it was just like a weird meandering plot because it didn't go. I mean, it didn't have like the sort of thrust you expect a good story to have.
I mean, I think instead of that, like what you're looking for, because like it had them living their lives, like them getting a house in Paramus and them having their baby, and like, you know, there was like a little scene where they kind of fast forward through a few years.
There was a montage.
The home movie montage while Paul Simon's Kodachrome plays in the background.
And they played like the whole song. I was expecting like just a verse or something, but nope. God damn it, they played that entire song.
Wow, yeah. Hey, when Lorne Michaels knows Paul Simon personally.
I guess he got a deal on the licensing.
You can do things like that.
Something I thought was kind of neat was the 3-year-old Connie in sequence was played by Dan Aykroyd's daughter Danielle, who was about, I guess she was about 3, because Dan Aykroyd took his daughter to the set, and she was so fascinated by the Conehead costume, she asked for one of her own. So they cast her as young Connie, so she could get her own cone.
That's sweet. Put your daughter in, yeah.
That's sweet.
I mean, that's one of the few times that's sweet.
Yeah. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. That's beautiful. And I think wasn't Dan Aykroyd's brother Peter in this thing too? He played a role somewhere here.
Probably. Yeah, I can't find that right now. But something we should talk about casting wise. Lorraine Newman, who played the daughter Connie on SNL, she was not Connie in this movie. Instead, they cast a young actress by the name of Michelle Burke. And apparently, Christina Applegate tested for it as well.
Oh,
they said they, in that interview.
Kelly Bundy?
I know. Uh-huh. And they part of the reason that they cast Michelle Burke was she looked good in a cone. I mean, that was important that she had to be. You know, not everybody I think looks good in that makeup.
Not everybody can sport a cone like.
Yeah, and
it's like, she had the cone on, and I still hit.
It was flattering for her. So yeah, good for you, Michelle Burke.
Yay.
And Michelle Burke is, she was also in Dazed and Confused.
What? That make Parker Posey and Joy Lord Asner in Dazed and Confused too?
Yep, and they play her friends in this movie.
Huh.
In the backseat when Beldar's driving him to school. So,
look at that synergy.
I don't know which one was shot first, but but they came out, I think, the same year.
I believe. Yeah. So. Or within like a year of each other. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So, so then, like, they grow up, and, but like you were saying before, you weren't finding there wasn't too much of a plot, because, like, it just showed more kind of true-to-life stuff, I guess. Like, it showed, like, them having issues with their marriage, or, like, them wanting to spice up things in their marriage, because, you know, Jan Hooks played, because in the movie, Beldar's a driving instructor.
Right.
And Jan Hooks is one of his students, and she's like all kind of tarted up, and she's all like making the moves on Beldar.
Yeah, and she makes a pass at him, and then it's just a scene, and that it doesn't really go anywhere beyond that. It's not, it's not part of this big subplot about problems in their marriage, and he doesn't have an affair with her. She doesn't like come back later in the movie, really.
Not really. Well, there's one point where Primat sees her in the supermarket, and they don't talk, but they just kind of walk by each other, and then Primat gets like a Good Housekeeping magazine and wants to spice things up.
It's just like a lot of little sequences. I think they were still too much in the sketch mode.
Yeah, you know? I can see that.
I mean, these are characters who were built for like 5-minute sketches, and I think they didn't really break out of that in this movie. We didn't really have a story for them.
Yeah. It wasn't like when Wayne's World there was a story.
Wayne's World had a story.
Yeah. I see what you mean.
And this was, they just were built for those 5 minutes. And also, like, the Conehead voices get grating very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Because it's Dan Aykroyd and Jane Curtin talking like this and using very formal language. And
wow, that was very good.
I mean, it gets old fast.
Yeah, that's probably one of the reasons I never really liked the sketch in the first place, where it's just them, they're just kind of using big formal words to say, you know, well, like instead of cheese, they'll say lactate extract from a hoofed mammal.
Yeah. Yeah, they have that very formal way of speaking.
And that's the joke where they use the big word.
Yeah, and you know, they would, on the show, they would always be like, consume mass quantities, and they'd like drink an entire six-pack of beer at once. But they didn't do that in this movie because it was, I think they were going for more of a family movie
thing. It is PG.
Yeah.
I mean,
it was PG. It's not even PG-13, huh?
No, PG. No one cusses. I mean, like, there's one thing, of course, where we see Beldar's butt, but he doesn't have a butt crack.
Yeah,
he has like two nubs.
That was one thing that amused me was beginning
Beldar's
of the
butt.
No. Well, no, at the beginning of the movie, before I started playing it, it flashed on screen, rated PG for quote comic nudity and double entendre humor. So I was like, oh well, I'm gonna see some comic nudity in this, and it was Dan and Aykroyd's butt without a butt crack.
Usually, when I say comic nudity, they mean a butt.
Yeah,
butt.
Yeah, because butts are comical.
They're pretty fun. They're pretty funny.
I was also very amused that the costume designer in the movie was named Marie France.
What?
I thought that was a weird coincidence. I saw that in the opening credits, and I made a note of that.
I come from France.
I also liked it. Like at the end of the movie, there was a gag where Connie is going to prom with her boyfriend Ronnie, Chris Farley, and Beldar takes a photograph of him, and he's got like this big Polaroid, but it's got all this extra stuff on it.
Yeah,
and he's got like three or four flash bulbs attached to it, and he takes a picture with that, and then it cuts back to Chris Farley, and he's sunburned from the flash bulbs. He's got like a grid pattern on his face. He looks like he just like stuck his face on an Eggo a waffle iron or something.
Yeah, that was pretty. See, there you go.
I enjoyed that. That was a gag funny towards the end of the movie, and I liked the sight gag of when they were all on a motorcycle and they all had the pointed motorcycle helmets.
See, there you go, sight gag.
So there were literally like two sight gags I kind of liked.
So there you go. You think it's hilarious? You heard it here, folks.
Yes,
John Trumbull.
That was
five stars.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, that's all I wrote. Yeah, that's pretty much all I wrote. Like the battle scene at the end, because at the we'll fast forward a little bit. I guess we'll come to the end of this thing because it's a pretty short movie. But so when the INS is on them and they're about to take them in, that's when the spaceship comes and beams them all up.
Right.
They're all in the car. And so they beam him up in a tractor beam or whatever it was. And then Michael McKean is like, no, they can't get away. So he grabs onto the car.
Yeah.
And then David Spade grabs onto Michael McKean. So they all get caught up in the spaceship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then they meet the grand leader, played by Dave Thomas of SCTV fame.
Right.
And he notices that Beldar's teeth are capped because
early
in the movie, the cone has to have like very sharp, like shark-like teeth.
They're shaped like they're cones.
Yes.
Yeah.
Cone. Oh yeah. Wow. I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, they're like slightly pointed teeth, but they're.
Look at that. See, that's brilliant. But yeah. So again.
Okay.
I'm trying to give this movie a little something. So yeah. So and on Raimi, like that scene as an act of defiance and treason. So Beldar has to fight the Narfle the Garthok. The big monster at the end, and he's able to defeat the Garthok because later in the movie they show he's very good at golf. He likes to golf quite a bit, and he actually wins a golf trophy in this Halloween party that they have in the movie. So he's able to sort of fashion a putter and use a rock as a golf ball, and he hits the golf ball in down the throat of the Garthok, and the Garthok chokes and dies.
I vaguely remember that.
That's the big finale battle scene. You don't remember that? He narfled the Garthok.
Yeah, I mean, I liked the Garthok. I enjoyed the stop motion animation
Sang Tainted Love a little bit.
Yeah, I just didn't remember all the golf ball stuff. I think I was, I mean, no, it was yeah. getting late at that point.
And, ooh, wow. Yeah. But yeah, throughout the movie, he was like a golfer. He was, yeah. he golfed.
Yeah, I remember him golfing.
Okay.
And so, he had like the golf trophy and.
Yeah, see, there you go. So yeah, so, and for, you know, since he was able to defeat the Garthok, Beldar says, I want to go back to Earth and, you know.
Right. But, largely because like Connie is. Yeah, you know, really wants to be back on Earth because she's in love with Ronnie, and and it's the only world she's known because she was born on Earth.
Absolutely. So, but he says to the leader, "I want to go back and we'll, you know, take over Earth and defeat the Blunt Skulls."
Yeah.
And then he says,
"I do like the term Blunt Skulls.
Blunt. That's a pretty. I'm surprised there hasn't been a band named the Blunt Skulls yet. That's pretty.
That's a great punk name. Yeah.
Dude, if any
Blunt
punk
band, Skulls, yeah.
If any bands are listening, you take that.
It's
you
a
run kick-ass with
it. Name.
So yeah. So then he says he wants to take one of the Earthlings back to Earth with him, and then the leader says, "You can only take one." So he takes back Michael McKean because he's of higher ranks, and David Spade stays on the planet, and he kind of becomes the David Thomas's kind of advisor. And he's like sliding his way into becoming the advisor to David Thomas.
Yeah.
So anyway, they go back down to Earth to take over Earth, but then Beldar says, "Oh, something happened. My spaceship is crashing. I think I'm about to be taken out." So he kind of fakes his own death.
Mm-hmm.
So all the Coneheads think he's dead, and you know, they see him as a hero, but he's not dead, and he wants to live on Earth. He goes on to live on Earth with his family for the rest of his life, and then he makes a deal with Michael McKean's character saying, you know, I saved your life, so give me a green card and don't bug me anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the end. That was it. Oh, and also...
If only real-life immigration problems were resolved so easily.
God, I know, that's what we got to do. Well, and also another thing I noticed that they did, because like earlier in the movie, he had that idea of putting shock collars on illegals from crossing the border.
Yeah.
And at the end of the movie, he had a shock collar on him. Him and
irony.
Yeah,
yeah.
See, get it?
Oh, I hadn't picked up on that, but you're right.
That was very sly. Did you not see that?
He got a little taste of his own medicine right there.
In your face, INS.
Yeah.
Yeah, take that. America.
So,
but yeah, I mean, as far as, that's pretty much the movie.
This movie didn't do so hot. It had a $33 million budget, as you mentioned before. It ended up making a little over $21 million in the United States. Never released overseas, so that was its total box office take.
It's not a huge flop, but it ain't great.
Well, I mean, a movie has to make what, like, three times its budget to really be considered like a hit or to make its money back, I think.
I think so. I mean, as long as you make the money back, then it's not. But yeah.
I mean, when you don't even reach the amount of your budget, that's bad.
Yeah. I mean, I also, now that I think about like the fact that this came out in 93, and I mean, the heyday of the Coneheads was like 70.
That's what I find so mystifying, is that it's like literally 15 years later, and it's like, was anyone clamoring for a Coneheads movie at that point?
No, I don't think so.
But apparently, like, this is like right after they formed, I believe, the SNL studios, and they were looking at SNL characters and properties they could put into the movies, and I believe the reason they settled on the Coneheads was because it had a big recognition still, because there were still like syndicated reruns of SNL and like best of video cassettes and
all
that, so like people knew who the Coneheads were,
but yeah, just not enough to warrant the movie.
Yeah, but I think it takes more than just knowing. Being aware of a property, I mean, that doesn't necessarily translate into I want to see a movie with this.
No,
thing.
I agree. That's why I feel like how the way people keep doing reboots and remakes now.
Like just this week, I don't know if you watched this. There was a movie trailer that dropped with Banana Splits.
Yeah,
but they've rebranded it as a horror film. And one of my Facebook friends was like, who did they make this for? Okay, the people who are old enough to remember the Banana Splits won't want to see this done with them. And the kids who didn't grow up on the Banana Splits won't care.
Yeah.
So this is like a movie literally for no one.
Yeah, very much. I mean, I remember the Banana Splits just because I used to watch like a lot of Nick at Night and I was in front of the TV all the time. So I remember them, but not enough to see a movie about them. Definitely not enough to see this sort of... was it a 5 days at Freddy's version of them, where they're like these animatronic monsters come to life? I mean,
it's just so weird. I mean,
it's the same way I don't understand why, like, how they made like a. Remember when they made the movie out of Bewitched?
Yeah,
like like in the 90s or the
And it had this overly convoluted premise too, where it was like Nicole Kidman was a real witch, and then she's cast in a movie version of Bewitched within the movie, and it was like
it's meta, man, just
make a Bewitched movie. I mean, if you have to make a Bewitched movie, which I'm not entirely convinced we did.
Yeah, we didn't. It's meta, man, just make a Bewitched movie. There's levels on top of levels. I think they're just thinking Hollywood now where, oh, do you remember that? Like how they said they wanted to do a remake of like Punky Brewster. It's like
with Soyel Moon Frye playing an adult Punky Brewster, and it's like, does anyone want to see that?
No, no one wants to see. Like, it's like just because I remember it doesn't mean it's enough to make a movie or a TV show out of it.
But I mean, apparently that revival of Full House was really successful on Netflix. I mean, I think they did like 3 seasons of that or something.
Yeah, I mean, that's a little bit...
And now Aunt Becky's going to prison, so that's probably done, but...
A very special Full House. Yeah. Becky goes to the Slammer. But I mean, that's a little bit more understandable.
I mean, that at least was on the same sort of brand. It was like a continuation of this. I mean, I think they did the same type of show they did before. I haven't watched it. But.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't either. I mean, I used to watch Full House on TGI Fridays because, you know, I was a kid and... You know, it's Friday night. You go watch TV. What do you do? Go out with your friends.
Yeah, I don't quite get why this movie exists. I don't even get why they thought it was necessary to recast Connie. You know, I mean, Lorraine Newman was older, but so were Aykroyd and Curtin, and they're aliens. Why the hell couldn't? Yeah, and we have Chris Farley.
Chris Farley put the teenager in this thing, and no one questions it.
Yeah, who had to? Well, or he was at least early 20s, I think, because he was working in an auto parts store.
But he's
like probably pushing 30 and he's playing this young guy.
Yeah, so what?
How old was Chris Farley when he passed away?
He was 33, right? Because the same age as Belushi?
Yeah, that sounds right. So
mid-20s, I'd say.
Okay, yeah. Well, but, he lived a hard life.
Yeah, ooh. And how.
Yeah, so I just thought it was weird and kind of disrespectful to Lorraine Newman to not have her be Connie. And she has basically what amounts to a cameo in the movie. She plays a conehead on the home planet.
Yeah, that was a little weird. Maybe they were trying to gear it towards a younger audience, so it's like, we need a young, hot young thing.
I guess. I don't know. I don't get the rationale. I would like to know more about why they felt it was necessary to recast.
Aykroyd, give us a call. You have some questions to answer for.
I don't quite get why Jane Curtin wanted to do the movie. You know, she didn't have enough Kate and Allie money at that point.
Kate and Allie. Wow, I haven't heard that in forever.
Yeah. Well, it was still a pre-Third Rock from the Sun era. Yeah. Third Rock from the Sun started a few years later. I looked it up.
All that Kate and Allie money, just piles of it. just everywhere.
Well, I mean, that was a successful show. I mean, it's not remembered today, but it probably ran for at least 5 years.
It ran for a good chunk, yeah.
Yeah.
But,
I mean, that's the first place I saw Jane Curtin, because that show was on when I was a kid.
And then you went back to SNL, or?
Yeah. And then I was like, oh, wow, well, Jane Curtin was on the original cast of SNL. That's kind of neat. And it was weird to me, because it was so far from what her brand was by then.
Yeah, yeah. The Kate and Allie, from what I remember, was a lot more serious, right? It was like more of a dramedy.
I think they did a few very special episodes. I think I remember one episode where I think Kate or Allie, whichever one she was like, stranded in the city without any ID or money, and so she was mistaken for a homeless person.
Oh.
So, I don't remember how that played out.
How'd that shake out?
But, you know, she spent a few hours walking in homeless people's
shoes. So, I understand their plight.
So, yeah, exactly.
Like, you know.
Because that's all it takes.
Yeah.
For a privileged white person, that's all it takes. We just need, like, a couple hours, and we're like, yeah, we got the gist of it. Yeah, we know.
I was hungry for like 5 hours.
Yeah.
So don't tell me I don't know struggle.
Exactly.
Jesus. Where did this tangent go off? All right. So, I mean,
I thought it was a very movie. It's not terribly funny.
It's amusing.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't laugh out loud once, but, you know, a couple things I was like, okay, well, that's a cute sight gag.
It's amusing and charming, but yeah, like it's one of those movies where it's just like,
But it doesn't really go much anywhere. I mean, and you've got some really good people in it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, Dan Aykroyd's made some great comedies.
He has.
Jane Curtin's a very funny person. I love Michael McKean.
Yeah.
David Spade was also in the movie.
Yeah. Ooh, wow. McKean played it kind of straight for this whole movie for the most part.
But he was like kind of...
he was a good foil.
He was a good slimy 90s villain. He had his hair all slicked back at one point, and I was like, oh, that looks very 90s.
Blonde and slicked back. That's
and like at one point, Connie comes down from upstairs, and she's got like a choker, and she's got like blue jean shorts and like black tights underneath, and it was like peak 1993.
Very 90s. Oh.
It was peak 1993.
Black velvet, little boy style. Yeah. Black velvet, if you please. But yeah, for the most part, I found the movie charming. It was all right. Wayne's World was a little bit better. Blues Brothers was definitely better. But
on a downward slide, my friend.
Yeah, I kind of didn't want to say anything, but yeah, like I think the Blues Brothers and Wayne's World episodes were kind of the best, but now we're kind of slipping into the doldrums.
This middle section is going to be tough because there were a lot of bad to mediocre films released from SNL in the 90s, and we're going to cover one of them next week.
Yay!
Next week, we're going back to Aurora, Illinois.
Yeah.
We're covering Wayne's World 2, the sequel to the phenomenal smash hit Wayne's World.
Yes. People demanded it. Clamoring. More clamoring. All this clamoring. Wayne's World 2. Wayne's World 2.
Oh, that's Wayne's World 2? No, actually, we're good.
Ooh,
thank you.
Wow.
Thank you. We're good.
Yeah. That's a little sneak preview of what you think about Wayne's World
2. Well, no, actually, I have no idea what I'm going to think about Wayne's World 2 because I've never seen it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to
this. This is fresh territory for me.
I'm looking forward to that, your thoughts about all these things.
At best, I've seen like a few minutes of it on TV. So,
all right.
I already have it borrowed from the library. I'm going to have to like renew it so I still have it to watch for next week's show.
Indeed.
But
all right.
I don't think anyone else is going to go to the library and say like I must see Wayne's World 2.
You don't think there's a rush
this week?
For...
I don't think so.
All right.
I don't think so. I think I can get away with keeping it for 2 weeks.
All right. You better hope it all works out.
It was weird. It was weird. And then after that, yeah, we got some other things that do not have a good reputation. I will say that.
After Wayne's World 2, it's gonna be
it's gonna
brutal.
Be a slog for a few weeks. It's gonna be a slog, man.
Brutal.
Why we do this to ourselves?
This seemed like a good idea at the time.
Yeah.
Now, as we do
it, you know, because it was bracketed by the we're doing it in sequential order, and it was bracketed by Blues Brothers, which we have fond memories of, Wayne's World, which was pretty good, and MacGruber, which you love.
Wait, you're gonna love. I'm gonna say it right now. You're gonna like.
I've seen like a lot of the beginning of MacGruber, but I haven't seen much beyond that, and I'm looking forward to seeing more of MacGruber. That will be like my reward at the end of.
There you go. It's like a carrot on a stick. Like
exactly.
You get through this, and you get the carrot.
Oh god, it would be so depressing if we were ending with one of the really bad ones. But
we're gonna end it on a high note.
That's right.
Like you do in the summer.
So, but I'm looking forward to Wayne's World 2. I'm hoping I enjoy that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, because there, you know, people are liking that, and I'm sure they'll have at least a few amusing moments.
It'll be amusing at the very least.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So, that's our podcast. You want anything to plug? Anything to promote? What do we got going on here?
No, I can't think of anything right now. I don't believe we've gotten any more interesting. Did we get any more interesting tweets or anything like that in the last?
In the last
week since I didn't check the Twitter. This morning, but
I don't think so. I think it's been pretty radio silent.
Okay, let's check on the Apple Podcast and see if anyone else has left a review for
us here.
Let's
do it.
Nope, that's the old one from June 6th from Danny Vega or Vaga.
Danny Vega.
That's what it looks like.
Vega.
So anyway, so if you want to rate and subscribe us, please find us wherever you listen to podcasts, and that always helps boost our algorithms. You can find us on Twitter at SNL Nerds Show.
Yes.
Darren and I are both on Twitter individually.
Yes.
You can find me at Trumbull Comic.
You can find me at Darren Credible, Twitter and Instagram.
Mm.
I do it all.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And, of course, the Patreon. We got a Patreon.
Patreon. If you go to non-productive.com, you can contribute to the Patreon. You can get episodes a little bit early.
Yeah.
And you help keep the show going. You help keep the lights on. You help keep this whole wonderful enterprise afloat.
Put some gas in this car we call...
In this comedic engine that we call the SNL Nerds.
This little comedy roadster that we got.
Yeah.
Chugga-chugga.
We need fuel.
Yes.
We need fuel. Like Beldar, we need to consume mass quantities.
Ah, you beat.
See? We tied it all together there.
See? You did learn something from that movie.
Map!
Map,
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 map.
Yeah. All right, I'm kind of tired of that now.
Yeah, I think we're done.
You do it three times, like, that's enough.
Yeah.
I get it. I get it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, yeah, that's our podcast, guys.
That's our show. So we'll see you next week for Wayne's World 2. Until then, good night.
Night.
This has been a Non-Productive Media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.